attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Patrick Frayne, author of what is surely the greatest book title in the history of words, Okay, Let's Do Your Stupid Idea. Patrick is well known and much loved for a willingness to share in often heart-squeezing detail episodes from a remarkable creative life. After devoting his 20s to the rock star dream, Patrick moved on to pursue the only career that was more uncertain and occasionally depraved, journalism. Stage diving's loss has been the creative world's gain, and Patrick is now a thoroughly entertaining feature writer for the Irish Times and a multi-award-winning critic. And now, the latest stupid idea he's having a crack at is appearing on this very podcast to share his bold new plan to become a demotivational speaker and help the rest of us dribbling drones to stop striving for stupid things and put that energy into stuff that actually makes us happy. Patrick says, there are far too many people out there encouraging us to maximize our potential and to follow our dreams and achieve our goals. Young people's social media feeds are full of overexcited people telling them how to optimize themselves. They tell them how to exercise better or talk to people they fancy better or how they should distance from the sheeple and schmucks who just work 9-to-5 jobs and to instead get side hustles and a grindcore mentality. I just want to be a corrective to that. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you. Thanks for that lovely introduction.
Any errors?
No, actually, everything's really well researched.
Nice. Well, we normally have 7. I think we've got 8 quick fires here. This one quite presumptuous. Apology. Guinness or Murphy's?
Oh, Guinness for sure. Although I'm from Cork originally, which is where Murphy's are from. So my Cork relatives would murder me for saying that.
Nice. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole?
Oh, that's really hard. They're both books that had a huge impact on me when I was a kid. I read The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole first, and it kind of blew my mind as just this. I don't think I realized how much irony and sadness was in it, but it kind of blew my mind as a kid and it was really funny. And then I read The Hitchhiker's Guide when I was about 2 years older, and that also blew my mind. So I can't choose.
Well, that's your one pass. I'll allow that. This is the music one, albeit with a primate flavor. The Monkees or the Gorillaz?
Oh, the Monkees. I grew up with the Monkees. So when I was a kid, the Monkees were on TV on RTE, the Irish network, every morning at about 12. And they're like the original Gorillaz. They're the first kind of manufactured band with kooky personalities, and they all live together in a house. And they're probably the reason I wanted to be in a band more than music. The idea that you could all live with your friends and have kind of mad adventures.
Nice. Lie, sit or stand?
Oh, I think that sitting is my hobby. I've realized as I got older that sitting is my hobby. I did a piece recently about going to the gym, and it was about how inactive I've been a lot of my life. And I remember once having a conversation with a doctor in which I argued that standing was exercise, and the doctor was saying, I'm sorry, Patrick, that's not exercise. So sitting is my hobby, and lying down is like my natural state. So like, I feel like sitting is something I do. Sitting feels active to me. Like it's something I do actively. I'm not even resting when I'm sitting. I'm enjoying having a sit down. Like someone else might enjoy a bike ride or going to the shops. And lying down, when I lie down, I always feel like, why don't I just do this?
I bet you're really good at it as well.
I'm amazing. And sitting. I said in a piece recently that if there was a magazine called Sitting Weekly for hobbyists who love to sit, I would actually subscribe.
Amazing. Right, next we've got cornflakes or corncrake.
Oh, corncrake. So in my book, I have a friend, my best friend and my oldest friend, who didn't want his real name used, so I used his nickname, which is corncrake. And corncrakes are a pretty endangered bird now in real life, but my friend is not endangered. He is still around.
Is he quite shy and appears in kind of wetlands?
He actually is quite shy and obscure, so it's a good nickname. Like, he's the kind of person, I was on an island recently where there were lots of actual corncrakes and you could hear them and they kind of make this sound that goes and you can't see them because they're hidden in the grasslands. And when I was listening to them, I was going, that's actually kind of like my friend Corncrake. I can imagine him just sitting hidden in the grasslands making an obscure noise.
Oh, wonderful. two more. Knowing me, knowing you, or from the Oast House?
Oh, like I love Alan Partridge. From the Oast House really cheered me up during lockdown. That came out during lockdown, didn't it?
Mm.
I think it did.
Probably
that, actually. I love Knowing Me, Knowing You. But from the Oast House, I feel like Alan Partridge has been getting better over the years. So I think maybe from the Oast House. He feels like a more rounded character now.
Yeah, I'm a huge Partridge fan, and I think From the Oast House is arguably his finest work.
Yeah, and the books are brilliant as well. The books are really funny.
Right, last one, rock star or paperback writer?
Paperback writer, because I was trying to be a rock star for like 10 years, or a kind of, like, we were in a kind of punky, saw ourselves as political kind of band. So I had these ideals that maybe I could be a rock star who lived on a commune and did everything ethically, but somehow was also really rich. And at a certain point, that kind of gave way. Like, I guess we failed. I mean, I don't see it as failure anymore, but I guess we didn't work as a band ultimately. But I was like 3 years into my other life as a writer when I realized I would have hated being a musician in my 30s. 40s, like the idea of being out late on Fridays and Saturdays or being out in the road, like I'm a real homebody. So writing while sitting on a couch in my own house suits me a lot better than being in a van with a lot of other smelly men driving between gigs at 2 a.m.
Amazing. You sailed through those then. Well, listen, I'm going to ask you to unpack that a bit more, because to start the show, we always ask every guest about their path to where they are now, finding that it's rarely a linear one. I've hinted, and you've just shared a little bit on one of your pursuits already. So could you start by telling our audience what was your first ever job and then what was your first proper job?
So my first ever job was, me and a friend at Corncrake, actually, when we were like 15, and another friend set up a lawn mowing business in our... I came up growing up in a town called Newbridge in County Kildare, put flyers around doors and we mowed people's lawns. I don't know if that counts as a job because we made, I'd say, enough to buy a can of Coke each. I think the real first job was I worked in a building site for 6 weeks and then was fired after falling through a roof because I was really bad at it. And I worked in a kebab shop and I worked in a nightclub cleaning up glasses. Those are all my early jobs.
Mm.
Kind of my first real job, although it was a job that was more like a really expensive hobby, was being in the band. In that, from the age of like 20 to maybe 29, I was in bands that we took it very seriously. We started in college and then I was on the dole doing it on and off, or doing mixers, like other kinds of bits of jobs and doing while being in a band. And it was our kind of core, it was my core thing for like a long time.
And why music? Was that something you just wanted to do since watching The Monkees?
I think so. Like, I think it was, I loved being in a band and I kind of feel like every young person should be in a band or something like being in a band. There's something about doing constructive group activity with people you like with your friends. There's like a bit of running off with the circus about it. You know, like some of my, I'd hate it now, like I said, but some of my favorite memories in my 20s are like a bunch of us in either hatchback cars or a van driving around Ireland or the UK, like just kind of for like a week, you know, we'd go on these tours of the UK where we'd kind of go over to the ferry in Holyhead and play Cardiff and Oxford and London and Brighton, and it was just such good fun. And I loved making stuff. And we were coming from a kind of punky background in that when we started, we weren't particularly good. You know, we couldn't really play. But that's also I also recommend that. Like, I think you can be really creative sometimes with things you're not expert at. And sometimes being an expert at something takes away a certain bit of creativity. One of the things I love when I look back is, like, we recorded a bunch of records and we put them out on our own label. And there's stuff on those records. And I'm a pretty good musician now. But when we made those first records, I wasn't. And there's still stuff on those records that I think is really good. Not by accident, because we worked hard at it, but kind of good because our imagination pushed beyond our capabilities. So when I was in school, I was really into kind of what would, I don't think they're uncool now, but, you know, what people might think of as uncool middle of the road rock music. You know, I was really into Eric Clapton and Dire Straits and Phil Collins. And then when I went to, I met my friend Dara, who was in the band with me, and he was really into really obscure punk music. And it was my first time meeting music that was all about like a wider meaning. You know, he was into a band called Crass, who were a big anarcho-punk band through the 80s. And so I kind of loved that mesh of the personal and the political and the musical. Like the fact that the band, it kind of stood for something bigger to me than just the music, even though I loved music. It was this idea that somehow with the band, you were also making a political statement, a change in the world. Like that stuff really appealed.
Yeah, I think there's, it's a sweeping statement, but I think there's something about that time of people's lives when they're around about 20 plus, where you're at your most revolutionary, and music and a band gives you that kind of medium to be revolutionary, I suppose.
Yeah, you can, like, it's that thing about like, okay, self-expression is great in itself, but the thing I love about art and culture and creativity is that it kind of hints at something more than just a thing, you know, like it hints at, like a rock band hints at something bigger. And depending on the rock band, that could be, you know, a rock and roll lifestyle if you're like a hair metal band. And if you're like a scuzzy little Dublin indie band, it like hints at some greater sociological meaning that probably isn't really there. But
did you study music growing up? Like, was there like a path? Because the reason this question is so important to us and to me, especially, because I know people worry so much about what they should be doing in order to start a career in whatever profession they're pursuing. And there's probably a misconception that you need to know early and, you know in your teens what you want to be and pursue that through college or university or whatever that route might look like. So was there a path you followed for music or even for writing?
There wasn't a path. Like, I did an English degree in Trinity College in Dublin, which is kind of where a lot of my band went to college as well. The guys in my band. I think that was, I mean, I really think the humanities are great. Like, in retrospect, it doesn't lead to a straight. I had no real plan. Like, we developed a plan that is not a very realistic one pretty quickly about the band, but I didn't have a plan. I do think there is something in being curious and interested in the world. I think humanities degrees are good for that. And I think if you're curious and interested in the world and you have enough confidence and work ethic, you will kind of find something. So I'm not sure a plan is all that. I think my generation, like I'm 49, and I do think there was a different attitude to things with that Generation X group of people. I'm not sure I know anyone who had a plan, you know, like, and in some ways it was an easier time. In the 90s. In Ireland, we didn't know that because when I went to college, Ireland was still a pretty recessionary place. But in retrospect, we were lucky in the latter half of the 90s, Ireland went into an economic boom. But I think curiosity is really important. Being interested in things, not doing things because you think you should or because you think there's a career in something. I think it's better to like activate your curiosity and then figure out if there's a career that has that, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that curiosity and finding something you're interested in is so key. And I think one of the challenges, therefore, is people who are, say, young at school, they can't know enough about the world to know what they are interested in yet, and yet they're decided or they're expected to make decisions that will ultimately frame a lot of their future.
Yeah, like, I think that's a shame. Like, I do think, looking at the people I know, a lot of people found their thing later. You know, and you do have to do it. There's a bit of trial and error in life, you know, and this can be more difficult for some people than others, depending on, you know, family support and finance and all that. But I do think finding your thing is not an exact science. There's a little bit of, I think it's important to live a little bit and then figure things out.
Yeah. Without intending to force a link here, is there a link between that trial and error and that wonderful book I mentioned in the intro? Okay, let's do your stupid idea.
Yeah, there definitely is. Like that, when as I wrote that book, it didn't start as a book. It started as an essay and then another essay. And then my editor thought there was a book in it. But when I look at it, a lot of that book is about enthusiasms. It's about stuff I'm into. It's about things I tried. And it was written in my 40s, a lot of it about younger period in my life, looking at it a bit more kindly than I did at the time. You know, like things like I wrote about the band. And I wrote about, we had a pirate radio station for a while. And all of these things, I think, kind of shaped me almost more than any kind of professional training did. You know, I did do a journalism course like back in the 90s. I don't think I got anything from it or anything. I think most of what I learned about journalism, I learned on the job. Like as I get older, I do think it's important to kind of be open-minded and find the things you're interested in and kind of dig into them and be curious about them and don't be ashamed of them. And I think they lead to places. I think, you know, like you have to take stock every now and again and, you know, make decisions, but I think you'll find those decisions are become no-brainers if you know what you like. Time, weather, and
always. We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V. Sunshine. Here we go.
The core reason why I even approached you to start with to come on and guest is because of a piece you wrote in December. The title was, I'm Becoming a Demotivational Speaker. Let's all have an averagely productive December. And without wanting to push this anywhere uncomfortable, you wrote, I know a bit about this. Earlier this year, I worked myself into a lather of stress and depression. How long have you been thinking about writing that piece and what are the core points?
I have a tendency to overwork. Like as I get older, I'm trying to kind of put boundaries on it. But the reason I wrote the piece was because I'd never done this before, and I'm lucky I have a good employer in the Irish Times, but I had to take a few weeks sick leave just because I kind of overworked and then I was kind of properly burnt out, like that kind of lack of joy, depression and anxiety, just anxiety that didn't subside. And after that, I had a lot of, like, I'm quite open about mental health stuff. So I had a lot of discussions or chats with people. It's so many people, it's through me talking about it, but also just independent of me saying anything, we're talking about burnout. And I was thinking about the culture and like what I see on social media. I've done a number of pieces in recent years about young people on social media, where just last year, me and a colleague, Jen Hogan, sat with young people and went through their TikTok feeds. And one of the things that was really striking was just how much of their world is telling them to be better, you know? And I was then conscious that actually that leaks into our world. Like there is so much about even mental health discussions sometimes end up in an almost blamey place that, you know, if you make the right choices, you will not have this. And I think too much focus was being put on the individual to sort out their own problems, or put in the individual to both excel and have good mental health and a good family life without discussing, do we have a society that facilitates that? And how do we create a society that facilitates that? And I think one of the things we have to do to create a society that facilitates better mental health and no burnout is to acknowledge that people are expecting too much of each other and expecting too much of themselves, and companies are expecting too much of people, and the wider culture is expecting too much of people. Like we can't, by definition, most of us can't be above average. So the idea that young people feel like they have to, and old people feel like they have to excel all the time doesn't make sense. So there was loads of things and loads of things ended up coming into that essay, you know, that I hadn't even thought about, like in my own brain, And when I put this down, a lot of people could relate to it. I kind of had this notion, I think a lot of people have this notion, is we're going to get through our to-do list and then we can rest. But the reality is we need to be thinking more like farmers, you know, cyclically. Like, we're always going to have stuff to do. So we need to kind of take a breath and slow down the process of what we're doing, and maybe not rushing at things like we're going to somehow have a moment where everything is done. I don't think any adult right now ever has a moment where everything is done. So part of it is accepting, okay, if that's the case, then we need to slow down the pace.
I printed out your article when you read it, and just to hold my hand up, it mirrors me in so many ways.
Yeah.
I equally find myself burnt out it tends to be around November, December every year. I get very physically ill from overworking. So this piece really did knock me for six. And I've highlighted so much of the article that it's become counterproductive. The non-highlighted bits stand out the most. But to the point you just made, you say in reality, most of us, most of the time, can only be average by definition. And in reading that line, I almost found there's a peace in accepting, I suppose, the futility, is that a word? How futile it is in terms of what you're aiming for. And I found that line really peaceful for some reason. And I keep having to remind myself.
Yeah, because I'm glad you got that from it, because I think one of the things that was getting to me was this notion that, like, everyone's very good at something and everybody excels, but we can't excel at everything all the time. But like, it would make excelling stupid apart from anything else. Like, a lot of the time we do our jobs well, but maybe just given the constraints on us, we can't do our jobs remarkably all the time. And the notion that people should feel bad if they're not remarkable all the time is silly, and it's impossible, and it puts stress on people. And I think I'm just trying to, like, I wrote it as a form of self-soothing as well, you know, to kind of embed things. I found it with writing the essays in my book as well, that sometimes the process of writing is about embedding something that you kind of feel to be true, but you haven't embodied yet, you know? And I find that writing it sometimes is useful for me. So I wrote that piece not because I'd worked something out that other people hadn't worked out. That essay was a process of me working it out, you know, and all those things were things I needed to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you said the response has been great. I, somewhat ironically, I know, given I immediately wanted to interview you and release a podcast about it, it went viral, I suppose, in my group of, I suppose, industry peers, which I found both quite telling, and there's an element of sadness that people would have to relate so hard to it. But equally, I found it quite comforting that people took so much from it. And in your intro, you say, you know, it's fine if you stay an extra hour in bed, play with that dog, take a long lunch, have a hobby, even if it's sitting. Okay? And it just makes you realize how many people are probably not doing these things. And these are the things, to your earlier points about, I suppose, the serendipity of life or chasing stuff that's curious and interesting, is that's the stuff that you lose from this kind of productivity hustle.
And I think it's also to do with, I mean, I think it's, I did touch on it in the piece, but I think it's to do with the deep structures of how we've structured things. Everything is about continuous growth. So we don't do a thing I think we should be doing, which is kind of sitting back sometimes and going, no, we did a good job on that. We don't have to, there's a constant pressure because of economic pressures to rush on to the next thing, and that you're only as good as the next thing. Whereas I think that we need to, And I think that's part of where I'm seeing burnout in people I know and in friends and colleagues who've talked to me about it, is this belief that, yeah, we did a great job on that thing. However, you're only as good as the next thing, which is a terrible message. And apart from anything else, like, and this is a bit woo-woo and wishy-washy, but I think it's true. We also need to, like, people are worthwhile in themselves, you know, you as well as what they produce. And there's an increasing feeling, and I'm saying this because I feel it a lot, like, that you're only as good as what you produce. And I don't think any of the people who love us think that about us, nor do I think even neighbors who know us partially think that about us. I think there's a wider sense of how you can be a person in the world that we forget when we're so far focused on work productivity in specific. But I think that work productivity thing can sometimes leak into our real lives where you sit on a Saturday and you want to have a productive Saturday, you know, which I think a lot of people who work hard end up doing, going, we need to make the most of the weekend, which I think is a leakage from work productivity. You know, productivity is not how we should see our lives.
Yeah, I think I tried to get to this question in my last point, but I think I just rambled a little bit about how much this affected me, because it truly did. But do you think it's cultural then, and it's not exclusive to any particular industry type?
I think it is cultural. I think there are things, like there's definitely things in my job that lend itself to that. Like newspapers have an all-consuming need for articles and material. So the need for stuff never stops. There's a lot of deadlines. I'm sure it's the same in your business. I think there are certain types of job that are more prone to it, but I also think it's a wider cultural thing. I think the more you look at the messaging from the culture, like one of the things, I mean, I touched on it, I think, briefly in the piece, but really started thinking about is like why so many people have side hustles instead of a hobby, you know? And the reason for that, I mean, there are economic reasons. It's partly because there's a lot of pressure on people. Cost of living is high. People feel like they should be. Sometimes people need an extra job. But I think it's also because there's a pressure put on people that even if they don't need an extra job, they should always be aspiring to something bigger and more productive. And in recent years, I have discovered the importance of hobbies. Like music has become my hobby. It was something I did as a main thing once. But now the importance of doing something, not because you're the best at it, not because you're trying to achieve something with it or you're building up to record an album, but just because you enjoy it and you get something from it in the moment with other people. Like there's something hugely worthwhile about that. And there's something weird about the way the culture wants us to turn our hobbies into side hustles. You know, this idea that anything you're passionate about should be a job. Like, I think that's deeply embedded in the culture and it's kind of problematic. And it stops us resting, because the difference between a hobby and a side hustle, I think, is that a hobby is restful and a side hustle is not restful. A side hustle brings all this pressure.
Yeah, totally. Do you think technology has kind of created part of this problem? You wrote that the anxiety is turbocharged by data collection. I almost feel, this is someone else's point I read a few months ago, that they feel missold by the, I suppose, the future predictions from our youth, which had robots doing our jobs so we could pursue these hobbies and spend more time with friends and family.
I think that the problem is that no matter what inventions they invent, if you put it into the current kind of economic paradigm, they will just be used to save time so you can then use that time to work on something else, you know? So if we had a different kind of society, like John Maynard Keynes predicted that by around now, we'd be working a 15-hour week, because he lived in a very socio-democratic world where if there was going to be savings made in time, it was going to be given back to the people. Whereas now, if there's savings made in time, I think it's going to be given back to the companies. So the companies will then go, we've saved this time, so now you're going to do this. And I think that the problem now with the technology is, firstly, the measurability. I think it was Joseph Stiglitz, the economist, said that what we measure is what we do. And I think there's an awful lot of good stuff that it can't be measured or is difficult to measure. And there's a lot of less important stuff that's easy to measure, you know, which is why presenteeism before lockdown changed it was so important and so stupid, because you could measure how long someone was in an office. So there's an awful lot of things that we end up being susceptible to purely because they're measurable, and they then occupy too much of our thinking time or our planning time. Like, I can speak in the context of journalism, like articles are measurable now. You can see, at least in terms of who reads them online, you can see how many people read something. That doesn't really help me as a writer. Like, it helps in a small way, but I found that it's still so unpredictable what does well. Like, you can predict if you write about something that's very popular, it'll do reasonably well. But the stuff that does hugely well is so unpredictable that I almost feel that measurability, there's too much emphasis on it. How much it helps you is actually way less than it should help you. And so I've stopped looking at the figures. I'm sure my bosses don't want me to say this, but I stopped looking at the figures because I found I was making decisions based on it and it wasn't actually helping how well pieces did anyway. So
there's have you heard of, I think it's, is it McNamara? McNamara fallacy? I think it's McNamara.
I don't think so.
So he was the US Secretary of Defense.
Oh, yeah.
During the Vietnam War. And I think he set the target of body count. I don't mean that to sound so crude.
Yeah.
And kind of reduced war to this mathematical model, which of course had all sorts of detrimental effects, not least to the, I suppose, the sentiment of what they were trying to do and the people that they were doing it to. But I think it's when a measure becomes a target, it can lead to all sorts of chaos. There's a similar story, and forgive me, I forget what country it was in, where there was an infestation of rats. And so the government started paying out for every rat tail that was brought in.
Yeah.
To equate to the death of a rat, but actually it just led to people breeding rats and cutting their tails off to cash in. I think there's a few stories.
There's a great, obviously fictional story in Catch 22, the Joseph Heller book. And it's about the Air Force and the Korean War. And it's one of the generals or one of their bosses is obsessed with neat bombing patterns that look nice in an aerial photograph. So there's this like running gag about how he is obsessed. He doesn't care what they hit. He just cares that the photograph looks nice and neat in the bombing pattern. He had his finger on something there. I mean, you can learn stuff from the figures. You can definitely learn stuff from the figures in terms of what people like generally in a newspaper. But I feel like the emphasis on it sometimes takes us away from thinking about stuff in a deeper way. And also, I think it does become a little overly mechanical then, you know, which leads to that sense of burnout and leads to a sense that you're being led by the figures rather than your own agency or even your boss's agency.
Yeah, for sure. And I mentioned I've a few listener questions to put to you, and I do want to get there soon because they're funny enough, they're all around this piece we've been digging into. But before we do, we have loads. I know we have hundreds of thousands of even of copywriters and writers of all shapes and sizes that listen to Call to Action. But I want to talk to you about writing. So what's your approach to writing and what makes for an interesting piece? Because you admitted off air that I think you were slightly surprised how well this piece in December did.
I think for me, I'm always looking for something new. So I'm trying to say something new or find something new. So I do a lot of different types of writing. Like I'll for the paper, I do a column, usually on TV or TV related stuff. I do a lot of kind of longish form reporting and a lot of interviews. And with everything, you're looking for something that stands out. Like you want to start with, like if I'm doing some reporting, you want to start with the most arresting thing you find. So if someone tells you a really amazing anecdote, you want to start strong and end strong. And usually for me with that sort of reporting, it's when I figure out what the start is and the end is, I can then kind of fill out the middle. I can kind of, you know, work out the skeleton from that. I try to avoid, like on a very practical level, try to avoid cliches. So if I can find my own way of saying something instead of a well-known turn of phrase, I will use that. And on a micro level, I think rhythm is really important. So the rhythm of how the words sound, I think, has a big impact on how people read. So like, you know, this is one of the problems I have with some of the, you know, Microsoft is Copilot now, or what was this? There was all these like writing suggestions that Microsoft Word used to do. Often it has no ear for rhythm. So it often wants you to remove a word because it thinks the word is unnecessary. And sometimes the word is unnecessary. Sometimes it's not because it's adding nuance. But sometimes, actually, usually it's not because it's adding nuance. And also it's usually adding rhythm. Like there's a well-balanced sentence when you hear one. And sometimes the most efficient way to write a sentence doesn't sound great, you know? So as I get older, as I've done more writing, I've realized that rhythm is really at the core of things, you know, breaking up your sentences so that there's sometimes a long sentence and a short sentence. If all the sentences are the same length, there's a lack of propulsion to it. And I think a lot of it is, I don't actually do this, but a lot of people say you should read stuff aloud.
Yeah, you don't do that.
No, I should, because people tell me I should. I think what I'm doing, though, is I am reading it in my head aloud, if you know what I mean. I think that rhythm thing I'm talking about is like, is kind of quietly reading it aloud. And I think that's what it's listening to. Like, you're listening to clunkiness. Hearing it in your head, I think, is important.
Have you read the Gary Provost, When the Writing Sings?
I don't think so.
Sorry, this might seem self-indulgent, but can I read it? I mean, it's not my
yeah,
wife.
Yeah.
I'm going to read it out to you. This sentence has 5 words. Here are 5 more words. 5-word sentences are fine, but several together become monotonous. Listen to what is happening. The writing is getting boring. The sound of it drones. It's like a stuck record. The ear demands some variety. Now listen. I vary the sentence length and I create music. Music. The writing sings. It has a pleasant rhythm, a lilt, a harmony. I use short sentences and I use sentences of medium length. And sometimes, when I am certain the reader is rested, I will engage him with a sentence of considerable length, a sentence that burns with energy and builds with all the impetus of a crescendo. The rollout of the drums, the crash of the cymbals, sounds that say, listen to this, it is important.
Yep, that's it. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
I hadn't thought about that for ages. And then when you were talking about rhythm, I looked it up because I knew we'd written a blog about it. But it's exactly that point. You're right.
Like, I think a lot of it is the oral roots of writing. And I think that bad writing is often entirely literary. And I mean that literary in a bad way as opposed to high art. I think you get it with some bad business writing. Like, bad business writing is kind of forgotten about tone. It's forgotten about the human bit of communication, and it's entirely about information, you know. And sometimes, sorry, it's not even about information, it's about the illusion of information. So there is, like, I mean, like, I love the Orwell stuff too, you know. Orwell talks about using, don't use a big word where a small word would do. I think that's often good advice. He talks about simplifying things down to the core. I do think there's fun sometimes in complexity for its own sake, because it can be, particularly in funny writing, because I write funny stuff sometimes, and you often find that the more complicated word is just funnier. But I think thinking about the effect on the reader, and thinking about, like, another thing I do a lot, particularly with reporting, and actually with my column sometimes as well, is I don't quite try it out in people, although if I'm having a coffee with someone, I might. But I think about, how would I explain this story to a friend? What would I start with? Like, if you were sitting with a friend in the pub and you were telling them about the research you've been doing, what would be the thing you'd want to tell them first? And that's often the thing to start the piece with. And again, that's just a way of thinking about, how does this affect the reader? What the order in which stuff is delivered has an emotional component. You know, sometimes you want to hit people right up front with the emotional component. Sometimes it's better to start kind of calm and steady and allow the emotion to build. But these are all decisions you end up making when you're writing a piece.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's quite coincidence, actually. I have this thing when I read writing with any type of wit that I refer to as my Clive James scale.
Oh, yeah. I love Clive James.
Yeah, well, there's echoes of Clive James in your writing. And it's really nice when you read wit. And I think that's where you said about the writing not necessarily being technically written. And I think that's exactly what it is. It's like the other end of the spectrum to technical writing is having that, you know, putting in a complicated word intentionally or adding a word where it is unnecessary technically.
And there's often a thing, like, particularly when you're writing jokes, like, the order of the information is really important. So there's sometimes, it's about, I think it's Kurt Vonnegut has a bunch of rules for writing. And the last one is, break any of these rules to avoid barbarism. But I often notice if I'm writing, like, trying to write something funny for my column, there'll be an order. And if you switch up the order, like, sometimes switching up the order is technically not quite correct. Like, you're sometimes breaking the rules in order to deliver the punchline last, which I am totally fine with, because I think there is correct writing and it's important to know what that is. But the main purpose of, at least the type of writing I'd be doing, is delivering the information in an engaging and entertaining way. And sometimes that involves breaking the rules a bit.
Yeah. I'm going to go to listener questions, Patrick. Well, So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or both names, is notoriously fraught with danger. I'm going to try and squeeze three in if we've got time. Paula asks, this is referring to your article on burnout. How do you believe different generations are affected by the productivity anxiety? Are older generations better equipped to battle it as they lived a life before, or are younger generations, as natives to the hustle culture, immune to it?
I don't think younger people are immune to it. In fact, I think they're swimming in it a lot more. I think that their leisure time is swimming in it a lot more, because if you look at, I'm noticing that like there's a lot of terms from the internet that just younger people I know just seem to know. Like I've heard the term passive income a lot from younger people, which is coming from kind of side hustle pushers on TikTok. It's also a side effect of there are fewer stable careers, I guess. And there are there's a little bit, like I said earlier, like when I was leaving college in the 90s, I was lucky enough, not straight away, but a few years later, Ireland was in boom. And also rents were cheap and there were jobs. Whereas I think part of the reason people are looking for side hustles now is because there aren't as many opportunities. So I think in some ways it's harder for them. I think my piece was being written to some degree from a position of comfort, in that I have a steady job with the newspaper. I have a supportive employer. I think these things are maximized for people who are kind of in the gig economy. So I don't know. And I also think that when the culture changes around us, we don't notice it. Like it is that, you know, the water boiling the frog thing, and our brain gets changed by it. And I think that's one of the things I became really struck by. I think the rise in burnout in the last couple of years, I think it's partly coming from the messaging of the culture around us, that things in the past we might have put down to systemic problems, we are being encouraged to think of as our problem. We're being encouraged to think of, that's because I'm not organizing my life well enough, or I'm not exercising enough, or I'm not, which are all, these are all fine messages, exercise, meditate. But we also need to be looking at, sometimes it's just not our fault, you know, sometimes things got harder.
Yeah.
So in answer, I don't think older people are immune to it.
No, it's a shame. I mean, you can probably unpack that even more with the next question, actually. And in fact, a question from Emily is very similar to one we've had from Elliot. So I'll read them both out and respond however you see fit. So Emily asks, what are some everyday antidotes to block out hustle culture? And Elliot asked, can you ask Patrick how I minus 10x my productivity? I need some motivation to demotivate.
What is 10x? That's a kind of term. That's like maximizing. I think it's more thinking about like what I came away with is, I don't think, like when I said I was going to be a demotivational speaker, it's partly a joke. I think it's more thinking about what you want from life and thinking about, I mean, these are kind of simple things that I've had to learn to do. Instead of thinking about your life in the future, which I think is one of the things we're being encouraged to think about with, you know, a lot of that productivity stuff, that sometime you'll be free, you know, or you'll get that passive income and you'll retire to your island or whatever. I think it's making peace with the fact that maybe your life isn't going to change drastically from what it is, you know, and I'm saying this to people whose lives are okay. Like, obviously, there are people who are suffering through things and your lives will change, right? Sure. You know, if you're going through a bad time or a bereavement, things get better. But I mean, looking at your life rationally and going, okay, what if my life doesn't change much? What's good in it? What do I want to focus on? My projects in the future, does it really matter if I finish them a month later than, you know, I'm thinking about right now? A lot of it is about, I mean, I hate talking about balance because it almost puts more pressure on people in a way. But a lot of it is thinking about what you actually want from life and looking at the bits of your life where you have that and going, well, it's kind of stupid old story about, you know, the man sitting on the beach and the millionaire going, when I'm rich, I'm going to sit on the beach all day. And the old man going, that's what I do anyway, right? Like there's loads of stuff we can do right now that we enjoy and we can work. I think I'm not averse to working hard. I'm averse to working too much. And I think it is reasonable to look at your life and go, How do I work hard with time off where I'm not working too much? And I think it's giving yourself permission to do that is important. Like, I don't even know what 10X is. And I don't even think the people who talk about 10X know what it is. I think it's just like it's a term to mean massive productivity. And I don't think if he worked whatever it is, minus 10X, that there's actually going to be a huge dip in productivity over the long term. I think it's more, his life might come into more balance in the now. And I don't like putting things in terms of, because I think the danger as well is talking about how if you do these kind of psychologically healthier things, you're going to be more productive anyway. I don't think that's the point. So I don't think we should even think about that. But there, I think what is true is you'll come back with a better perspective on the stuff you should be working on and the stuff you shouldn't be working on. Like, we all find that when we take breaks.
Yeah, I'm pleased you said that, because my mind was drifting to that point and wondering whether actually in the long run you'd be better for it from a productivity perspective. But of course, that's the wrong lens entirely.
I think part of what I was spotting when I was writing the piece and when I was going through what I went through earlier in the year is that some of the productivity is stupid productivity. Like some of it is there's worthwhile stuff. There's in everybody's job, there are things you do where you go, that was worthwhile. And there's things you do that you go, actually, I don't know if that was worthwhile. I feel like that was busy work, or that was, you know, I was on an overworking role. So I did this extra thing that isn't really good and isn't really necessary. And it was because I was addicted to the kind of pat on the back you give yourself when you work too hard.
Yeah. We're going to link to the piece, obviously, in this episode's listing, and I encourage everyone to read it. But I must just share one more thing, which is your close, which is, I'm only writing it now because I couldn't be asked doing another piece I've been meaning to write. I'm going to head to four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests, Patrick, starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I think I was very anxious when I was younger. Like, I still have issues with anxiety. I think I would tell myself that you're not making anything better by worrying too much.
You're right.
Yeah.
I come from a similar kind of mind space as well. I'll probably give myself similar advice. And it's funny, I see it in my children. And it's really strange, because I think as a father, I'm really able to give out this wonderful advice. And then clearly dealt with things slightly differently myself.
I think people who worry are slightly addicted to the idea that the worrying is making you better doing stuff. I don't think it is. Like, I think there's a line between being conscientious and being neurotic. And I mean, I wish I knew where the line was, but like, conscientious is good. Neurotic doesn't make things better. You know, you end up working extra hours. This is back to pointless busy work. You know, you end up doing extra stuff because you feel you should. And then in retrospect, when you think about it, you went, yeah, that last 2 hours of work, I don't think that was necessary. And it came from the neurosis.
Yeah, totally. Number two, if you could banish one thing from your industry, what would it be and why?
I mean, there's things I can't banish that I wish I could. Like, I'd love to be working in the industry of the past where you didn't. There was no way of knowing how pieces did. But obviously, that's like, obviously, there's really good things in the modern world as well. If I could banish something, I think it would be short-term thinking. And one of the problems with the modern media landscape is everything is so reactive. I think we're thinking an awful lot about what's happening right now in news media. And it would be a lot better if, it's very hard to do this in a thing that's constantly moving, but if we could kind of think a little bit more long-term, plan things a little bit longer, dig deeper into things. It's difficult now because the audience is so hungry for the now. And I think if journalism had a strength in the past, it was that there was a slightly longer term view on things.
Yeah. It's funny how often short-term thinking comes up, not necessarily on the podcast, but as a criticism of various industries, because I'm living in Adland, and that's certainly true here too. Number three, are there any books that you would recommend to our listeners?
Oh, there's an amazing book by my colleague, Sally Hayden. She writes for the Irish Times. She's a foreign correspondent, and she wrote an incredible book called The Fourth Time We Drowned, which is about the migrant routes into Europe and the way the EU and the UN has kind of dealt with them. It's a big, thick book. It's an incredibly detailed anger making read. So that's probably the best work of journalism I've seen in recent years. My brain, I read a lot, but my brain is struggling to find what I read recently. I started writing a novel last year. And before doing that, I reread two books that I loved in recent years. Commonwealth by Anne Patchett and A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. And I reread them because they're both books that are told by multiple narrators over long periods of time. Quite different books otherwise. And I love that in novels. Highly recommend both those novels. And I reread them and I don't typically reread. Since then, I've started rereading things because my wife, Anna Carey, who's also a writer, she rereads a fair bit. And I never really got it before. And what I hadn't really realized until I was doing it this year, it was how much you forget in novels.
Yeah.
There's the stuff that you really remember that stuck with you. And then you read the book and you go, I've totally forgot about this plot point or this subplot. And it's almost like reading a new book. So those three books I highly recommend.
Amazing. What do you think about audiobooks?
I haven't done them. I listen to a lot of podcasts. Audiobooks, I found I walk a lot and I listen to podcasts when I walk. And I tried a couple of audiobooks and I kind of daydream when I walk a bit. So I kept missing this. Whereas with a podcast, you can kind of catch yourself up. You know, if you daydream or see a funny dog, you know, and miss a bit, you can kind of catch up. Whereas in a novel or even a longer book of nonfiction, you've got to skip back. So I'm not quite on the audiobook train.
Yeah, I always wonder what you know, talented writers think of audiobooks, because it's almost as if you've taken the craft, which is, of course, the bit that's so loved and respected by writers, and translated it into a different media. I wonder if that's a thing.
Loads of writers I know do listen to audiobooks. And I think it's still the craft. Like, I think in fact, you kind of hear a different bit of the craft, kind of in the same way that people recommend reading what you write out loud. I think when you listen to someone read a work of fiction, that's probably quite good for your writing. You know, like if you're listening to someone read a really good bit of writing, the rhythm of that, like we were talking earlier, is probably going in a different way to when you read it. So I don't think it goes against the craft in any way.
That's good.
Yeah.
So like listening to music via, I don't know, Braille.
I don't think it is, because I think actually, I think when you're reading, a bit of your brain is kind of reading out loud to yourself anyway.
Okay.
It's more just my attention span. When I have a book in front of me, I can focus better than when I'm listening to something.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then number four, Patrick, we always dedicate every episode to someone and we bestow or hospital pass that honor, depending on your view, to our guest who has to give their reason why. Would you dedicate this episode?
Dedicate the episode to someone in particular?
Yeah. Anyone and someone.
I think I'm going to dedicate this to my wife, Anna Carey, who has a really amazing book coming out later in the year called One Song, which is also about bands. And it's a fiction romance, funny romance. So I'm going to dedicate it to her. She's probably my biggest influence. Like, we share what we write a lot just to kind of get feedback. And I think it's actually, for people who write, having other writers in your life is really useful. You know, having people you can show stuff to and get honest feedback from. So I dedicate it to Anna.
Amazing. This episode is very proudly dedicated to Anna. Can we link to One Song?
It's Our Song.
Our Song.
I think it's up on Amazon. I will send you a link.
Amazing. I meant to ask you earlier, Patrick, before I close the recording, what was your band called back in the day?
Oh, I was in two bands. One with Anna, my wife, which was called El Diablo, which was a alt-country band. And then the other band that I was in longer was called the National Prayer Breakfast, or the NPB. You can find some of that stuff on SoundCloud. There's one of the El Diablo records. It's called The 23rd Sam Cafe, is on Spotify.
Oh, amazing. I'm going to link to what we can find. I'm also going to link to OK, Let's Do Your Stupid Idea, The Fourth Time We Drowned, Commonwealth, A Visit from the Goon Squad, Our Song. I'm going to link to the piece that we have kind of dissected and to your profile on the Irish Times. How else can our listeners get more Patrick framed?
Well, I'm hoping to have a novel at some point soon, but largely the Irish Times. I write there every week.
Great. Are you active on socials?
I'm on Blue Sky now. I'm detoxing myself from Twitter, where I would have been active in the past. But yeah, I'm not, partly in the context of what we're talking about, I'm kind of pulling away from social media more. I'm finding it fun in small doses, whereas I think a lot of us were living on there for a while, and I don't think that's healthy.
Yeah, no, I echo that too. Amazing. Well, listen, Patrick, I'm so grateful that you guested and you found the time to talk today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Giles. It was fun.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Make sure you read Patrick's writings. Keep the questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can email calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.